There are people who wear kindness the way others wear armor. Not loudly, not dramatically, but carefully. Stitched together from the right words, the right credentials, the right smiles at the right moments. They don't look dangerous. They look helpful. They look like the person you'd call in a crisis. The one you'd trust with your darkest secrets. The one you'd never ever suspect. And that's what makes them so effective. Tonight's story is not just about murder. It's about control. The invisible chains that bind tighter than any rope. It's about manipulation, so sophisticated that victims don't even recognize the cage being built around them until the door locks shut. It's about a man who built his entire life around understanding abuse, studying it, teaching others about it, working professionally to prevent it, while committing some of the most calculated acts of violence behind closed doors. And it's about a woman whose voice was taken from her, whose anatomy was stripped away piece by piece, but whose story still demands to be heard. This is Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale, and before we go any further, I need to tell you something important. This episode contains detailed discussions of coerced control, psychological abuse, sexual violence, and murder. If you're in a place where you can't engage with this content safely, that's okay. Take care of yourself first. This story will be here when you're ready. Tonight, we're talking about Stephen Zelich, former United States Marine, educated professional, domestic violence prevention worker, a man trusted by institutions specifically designed to protect the most vulnerable members of our society. A man who understood abuse so intimately, so completely, because he was actively living it. And that understanding made him one of the most dangerous predators I've ever researched. This is a story about masks, about the performance of goodness, about how evil doesn't always announce itself with violence. Sometimes it whispers in the language of care. Let's begin. Stephen Zelich understood something fundamental about human nature. He understood that we make judgments about people within seconds of meeting them. We assess trustworthiness before we even process conscious thought. We look for signals, body language, tone of voice, credentials, social proof. And Stephen knew exactly which signals to send. Former United States Marine, that alone carries weight. It suggests discipline, honor, service. It suggests someone who understands sacrifice, who follows a code and protects rather than harms. Stephen wore that identity like a badge. He mentioned it early in conversations, let it color how people perceived everything else about him. But military service doesn't vacate someone against cruelty. If anything, it can provide tools, understanding of hierarchy, of control, of breaking down a person's resistance systematically. In Wisconsin, Stephen built a reputation that opened doors throughout the community. He pursued education in fields adjacent to psychology and social work. He learned the academic language of abuse, the terminology, the theories, the intervention strategies. And then he did something remarkable. He got a job working with domestic violence prevention programs. Think about that for a moment. A violent predator working to prevent violence. He sat in rooms with victims, women who had survived unspeakable trauma, women who were trying to rebuild their lives, who were learning to trust again, who were at their most vulnerable. He spoke about power dynamics, about warning signs, about the cycle of abuse, tension building, incident, calm, about coercive control, about how abusers isolate their victims. He knew the language fluently because he spoke it every day, just in a different context. He knew what survivors needed to hear because he knew what they feared most. And perhaps most dangerously, he understood how intuitions work, how cases are investigated, how victims are scrutinized and questioned, how doubts creep into investigations long before justice ever arrives, how easy it is to discredit someone who's already been traumatized. That knowledge would become his greatest weapon, because monsters who look like monsters don't survive long in our society. They're identified, isolated, removed. The dangerous ones, the truly dangerous ones, hide in plain sight. They don't lurk in dark alleys. They volunteer at community centers. They have impressive resumes. They speak at workshops about recognizing predatory behavior. And everyone believes them, because why wouldn't you? Her name was Jenny. And before she became a case file, before she became evidence, before she became another statistic in the epidemic of violence against women, she was a person. She was young, in her 20s, creative, the kind of person who noticed small, beautiful things that others walked past. She took photographs. She wrote. She had dreams that extended beyond the circumstances she'd been born into. Jenny was sensitive, not in a way that word is sometimes used to diminish someone, but in a way that means she felt things deeply. She cared about people. She wanted to help. She saw potential in situations where others saw only problems. She wasn't reckless. She wasn't naive. She wasn't any of the words that get thrown at victims to suggest that somehow deserved what happened to them. She was human. And like many humans, Jenny had experienced hardship. Life had given her more chaos than comfort. She'd known instability. She'd known what it meant to wonder where safety would come from. So when she met Stephen, this calm, articulate man who seemed to have his life together, who seemed stable and secure, she didn't see a predator. How could she? He was everything her life had been missing. He listened in a way that felt rare. Not the performative listening where someone waits for their turn to talk, but genuine attention. He asked questions about her life, her interests, her hopes. He remembered details from previous conversations. He spoke with certainty about things. He seemed to know how the world worked. He had opinions, convictions, a sense of direction. He made her feel chosen, not just wanted, chosen. As if out of all the people he could have been interested in, he'd selected her specifically. As if she had qualities that set her apart. That feeling of intoxicating when you've spent your life feeling overlooked. And slowly, so slowly, it barely registered. Stephen began to shape her world. This is how coercive control works. It doesn't arrive screaming. It doesn't announce itself with violence on day one. It whispers. It arrives as concern, as love, as protection. It arrives as a man who cares so much that he just wants to make sure you're safe. At first, Stephen's control looked like the behavior of someone deeply invested in the relationship. He asked where Jenny was going. Just casual questions. The kind any partner might ask. Where are you headed? Who are you meeting? When will you be back? Simple inquiries. Normal on the surface. But frequency matters, intensity matters, and most importantly, consequences matter. Because when Jenny gave answers, Stephen began adding commentary. Really? That neighborhood? At that time of night? I don't know about that friend. She seems like she's going through some stuff. I don't want you getting pulled into drama. 3 hours? That seems long for just coffee. He framed everything as protection. And when Jenny questioned it, when she felt that small, uncomfortable feeling that something wasn't quite right, Stephen had an answer ready. You're overreacting. Four words that can silence a person faster than a threat. Because if you're overreacting, then the problem isn't his behavior. It's your perception, your judgment, your emotional regulation. I'm just worried about you. After everything you've been through, I think you should be grateful someone cares this much. And there it is, the subtle reframe that transforms control into care, that makes resistance seem ungrateful, that suggests any discomfort you feel is actually evidence of your own issues rather than his problematic behavior. Little by little, Jenny learned that peace came from compliance. It's learned through pattern recognition, through the subtle shift in Stephen's mood when she made choices he didn't approve of. Though the questions that felt less like curiosity and more like interrogation. Though the emotional withdrawal that followed anything he perceived as defiance. Jenny learned that the easiest path, sometimes the only path that felt safe, was to simply agree. To check in constantly. To modify her plans. To cancel when he seemed uncomfortable. To choose him over other relationships. And compliance came at the cost of her independence. But she didn't see it happening. That's the insidious nature of coercive control. Each individual step feels small enough to justify, reasonable enough to accommodate. It's only when you look back at the full journey that you realize how far you've traveled from yourself. Without it, victims have perspective. They have people who notice changes. They have support systems that might intervene. They have escape routes. Abusers know this. Stephen didn't cut Jenny off from everyone all at once. That would have been too obvious. It would have raised immediate red flags. Friends and family would have noticed. They would have asked questions. Instead, he poisoned her relationship one by one. Criticized her friends, never harshly enough to seem unreasonable, but consistently enough to plant doubt. I don't know. Did you notice how she only calls when she needs something? He seems kind of manipulative, don't you think? The way he talks about his girlfriend? I just get a weird vibe from them. I can't explain it. These comments accumulated. Each one was small. Dismissible. But together, they created a narrative. Jenny's friends weren't really good for her. They were using her. They had motives. They didn't understand her the way Stephen did. He did the same thing with her family. He questioned their intentions. He pointed out past hurts, times they'd disappointed her, times they'd been unavailable, times they'd made mistakes. I know you loved them. But they've really let you down, haven't they? After how they treated you, I'm surprised you still make so much effort. I just think you deserve people who actually show up for you. And bit by bit, the web of relationships that had surrounded Jenny's life began to dissolve. Not because she wanted them to, but because Stephen had made it easier to withdraw than to fight his perception. He suggested that no one understood her the way he did, that other people didn't really see who she was, that their relationship was special, deeper, and more authentic than the superficial connection she had with anyone else. And eventually, Jenny began to believe it, because when someone controls the narrative long enough, when they're the loudest voice in your life, when they've removed all the competing perspectives, their version becomes reality. Jenny found herself alone. Not physically. Stephen was always there. But isolated in every way that matters. No one to check in with. No one to notice the changes. no one to offer different perspectives or suggest that maybe, just maybe, this wasn't healthy. Just Jenny and Stephen, which was exactly what he needed. Stephen monitored Jenny constantly. Her phone became a tracking device, not through some sophisticated spyware, though he had that too, eventually, but through simple, relentless attention. He wanted to see her messages, all of them. Text conversations, social media DMs, email exchanges, boring stuff that meant nothing. He demanded passwords, framed it as transparency, as trust, as what people do when they have nothing to hide. If you're not hiding anything, why would it bother you? It's a trap, because refusing suggests guilt, but complying means surrendering the last private space you have. Jenny complied. Stephen read through her conversations, looked at her photos, checked her browsing history, monitored who she followed, who followed her back, who liked her post. He created a complete surveillance, not just of her actions, but of her social connections, her interests, even her thoughts as expressed online. And when he found nothing, because Jenny wasn't hiding anything, wasn't being unfaithful, wasn't doing anything wrong, he accused her anyway. Why were you talking to him? What did she mean by that comment? You seem different lately. Is there something you're not telling me? In abusive relationships, innocence doesn't protect you. It only frustrates the abuser. Because the surveillance isn't really about discovering wrongdoing. It's about maintaining control. It's about ensuring you never feel safe, never feel unwatched. Stephen needed Jenny to understand that privacy was a privilege he could revoke at any moment. That her life was transparent to him, that she existed under constant observation. And when he couldn't find actual guilt, because there wasn't any, he manufactured it from innocent interactions. A friendly conversation became suspicious. A delayed response became evidence of deception. A night when her phone died became a deliberate attempt of hiding something. Jenny learned that the truth didn't actually matter. Stephen's interpretation of the truth was what mattered. And his interpretations always, always pointed towards her guilt. What Stephen did next transformed control into captivity. And this is where the story became particularly difficult, where we have to confront the reality that abuse isn't just about psychological manipulation. It extends into sexual exploitation. Stephen coerced Jenny into sexual acts she did not consent to. Let me be clear about what that means. Coercion removes consent. When someone is pressured, threatened, manipulated, or worn down until they comply, that is not consent. That is assault. And Stephen didn't just assault Jenny. He recorded it. He took photographs, videos, created a digital archive of Jenny's most vulnerable moments, moments she never agreed to document, moments she never wanted preserved. They weren't keepsakes. They weren't intimate memories shared between partners. They were leverage, insurance, collateral. Stephen told Jenny what these images meant. He explained with the calm clarity he'd learned in his professional work exactly what would happen if she ever tried to leave. If she walked away, those images would be shared with her family, people she loved, people whose opinions mattered to her, with employers, because he'd find out where she worked, and he'd make sure they saw exactly who they'd hired, with the world, posted online, distributed across platforms, attached to her name permanently. And just like that, Jenny's body became a bargaining chip. Her sexuality became a weapon pointed at her own future. Her most intimate moments became chains binding her to someone who had systematically destroyed her sense of self. This is sexual exploitation. This is coercion. This is abuse. And it is devastatingly, horrifyingly effective. Because shame is a powerful silencer. Because victim blaming is still pervasive. Because we live in a world where people ask, why didn't she just leave? Without understanding that leaving might mean having your life destroyed in a completely different way. Stephen understood this. He understood it academically. He studied it, taught others about it. And he understood it particularly because he was actively doing it. He knew exactly which fears to exploit, exactly which threats would be most effective, exactly how to ensure Jenny felt trapped with no possible escape. Here's the part that makes this case uniquely disturbing. Stephen wasn't guessing. He wasn't improving his abuse strategy through trial and error. He was trained. Every tactic he used, every manipulation he deployed, every psychological pressure point he exploited, he'd learned about them professionally. Think about the position he held, domestic violence prevention worker. That means he attended trainings about how abusers operate. He studied case files. He learned that tactics are most effective at trapping victims. He understood the psychology of trauma. He knew how victims hesitate to report, how shame and fear kept them silent, how self-blame erodes their confidence, how isolation makes them feel like they have nowhere to turn. He knew how the legal system struggles to recognize coercive control, how it's much better at dealing with physical violence than psychological warfare, how prosecutors need concrete evidence, how defense attorneys will attack a victim's credibility, how cases fall apart when there's no clear proof. And Stephen weaponized every single bit of that knowledge. He told Jenny that no one would believe her if she reported him. He reminded her that he worked with abuse cases, that he knew how these investigations went, that victims like her, with complicated pasts, with no visible injuries, with nothing but their word against his, were routinely dismissed. He told her that if she went to the police, they'd see his credentials, his professional reputation, his work preventing the very abuse he was committing. And they'd see her, isolated, emotionally damaged, with no witnesses, no evidence, no corroboration. Who would they believe? And tragically, devastatingly, he wasn't entirely wrong. Coercive control is incredibly difficult to prove. It leaves no bruises. It generates no medical reports. It's a he said, she said in the most literal sense. And when he is a respected professional who works in domestic violence prevention, while she is an isolated young woman with trauma in her background, the powerful imbalance is crushing. Stephen had studied this dynamic from every angle. He knew exactly how to position himself, how to maintain plausible deniability, how to make everything look consensual from the outside while maintaining absolute control on the inside. He was an expert abuser, and that made him more dangerous. Over time, something fundamental happened to Jenny. Her sense of self began to erode. Not all at once. Not dramatically, but gradually, like water wearing away stone. Stephen dictated her emotions, not just her actions, her internal experience. If she was upset about his behavior, she was being unstable, over-emotional, unable to regulate herself properly. If she was quiet, processing, needing space, she was being suspicious, hiding something, pulling away because she had ulterior motives. If she resisted his control in any way, questioned a decision, expressed discomfort, tried to maintain any boundary, she was being ungrateful, difficult, unreasonable. There was no winning, no combination of behaviors that would lead to peace, to acceptance, to being treated with basic respect. There was only surviving, and surviving meant enduring. Jenny stopped trusting her own perceptions. When she felt uncomfortable with something Stephen did, she'd second guess herself. Maybe she was overreacting. Maybe she was being too sensitive. Maybe her judgment was off because of her past experiences. Stephen encouraged this self-doubt constantly. "You're always so defensive. Why do you twist everything I say? This is why people have trouble with you." Each statement chipped away a little more of her foundation. Each interaction left her less certain of her own reality. This is what psychological abuse does. It doesn't just control your actions. It colonizes your mind. It makes you question your own thoughts, doubt your own feelings, distrust your own judgment. It makes you dependent on your abuser to tell you what's real. And once someone has that kind of power over you, escape becomes almost unthinkable. Because how do you leave when you can't trust yourself to make that decision? How do you seek help if you're not sure if you're being abused or if you're just broken? How do you ask for support when you've been isolated from everyone who might offer it? Jenny was trapped, not just by Stephen's external control, but by the internal confusion he created, by the erosion of her own sense of reality. And that's exactly where Stephen needed her to be. By 2018, something shifted in Jenny. Despite everything, despite the surveillance, the isolation, the exploitation, the psychological erosion, some part of her recognized that this wasn't sustainable. She couldn't articulate it clearly, maybe. Couldn't fully name what was happening to her, but she felt it. This wasn't love. This wasn't a relationship. This was captivity. Jenny began talking about leaving, not loudly, not as an ultimatum, but in small ways, mentions of what life might look like if she lived alone, thoughts about moving to a different area, questions about whether the relationship was really healthy. She imagined life beyond Stephen's control. And maybe that's the bravest thing a person can do when they're being abused. Imagine that something different is possible. Allow themselves to hope that they deserve better. But in the mind of an abuser, that possibility is intolerable. For someone like Stephen Zelich, control wasn't just a behavior. It was identity. It was how he understood himself in the world. It was the foundation of everything. Jenny wasn't a person he loved. She was a possession he owned, and possessions don't get to leave. This wasn't a crime of passion. Let me be absolutely clear about that. Stephen didn't lose control in a moment of rage. He didn't snap under pressure. He didn't act impulsively. This was calculated. This was a decision made by someone who understands exactly what he's doing, exactly what the consequences would be, and who chose to do it anyway. Stephen decided that Jenny would not leave, not to rebuild her life, not to find healing, not alive. What happened next, the specific details of how Jenny died, I'm going to handle carefully, not because I want to shield anyone from reality, but because Jenny deserves dignity, even in death. What matters is this. Stephen killed her. He ended her life deliberately. This was not self-defense. This was not an accident. This was not a tragic misunderstanding. This was an act of possession. Because if Stephen couldn't own Jenny's life, if he couldn't control her choices, couldn't dictate her future, couldn't keep her trapped in his carefully constructed cage, then he would own her death. It's the final expression of coercive control, the ultimate assertion of power. The moment when an abuser decides that death is preferable to disobedience. Stephen didn't panic afterward. He didn't call for help. He didn't confess to a friend or a family member in a moment of guilt or horror. He didn't do what someone might do if they acted impulsively and were now facing the consequences of an unplanned action. Because this wasn't unplanned. Stephen dismembered Jenny's body. He systematically took apart the physical evidence of what he'd done. He placed her remains into trash bags, heavy duty, the kind designed not to tear, the kind you'd use if you were disposing of something you really didn't want discovered. And then he got in his vehicle, and he drove across highways that stretched through the darkness, across state lines, because Stephen understood jurisdiction. He knew that crossing state boundaries complicates investigations, makes coordination harder, creates legal complexities. He stopped at multiple locations, remote areas, places where trash could be left without immediate discovery. And at each stop, he disposed of pieces of Jenny. This wasn't just about hiding evidence. About making Jenny disappear, not just from life, but from existence. About scattering her so thoroughly that she couldn't even be properly mourned. It's one more level of control, denying the person any dignity even in death. As Stephen drove through the night and into the next day, life continued around him. Other drivers passed, families were traveling, trucks were making deliveries. People stopped for gas, grabbed coffee, used rest stop bathrooms. Nobody knew what he carried. Nobody noticed anything unusual about him. Just another person on the highway, heading somewhere. This is the terrifying ordinariness of evil. Monsters don't always look frantic. They don't always draw attention. They don't always stand out. Sometimes they look calm. Sometimes they look like everyone else. And that's what makes cases like this so disturbing, because Stephen could have been the person next to you in line, the person pumping gas at the next pump, the person ordering coffee while you waited for your drink. You wouldn't have known. You couldn't have known. Evil doesn't announce itself with a soundtrack and dramatic lighting. It moves through the world quietly, blending in, hiding in plain sight. Eventually, of course, someone noticed Jenny was missing. When people disappear from their lives, when they stop responding to messages, stop showing up to obligations, stop being where they're supposed to be, questions arise. And when those questions reached Stephen, he had answers ready. He thought about this, prepared for it, rehearsed the story in his mind. But here's the thing about lies. They require perfect execution. One timeline inconsistency, one detail that doesn't quite fit, one statement that contradicts something you said earlier. That's all it takes for doubt to creep in. Stephen's explanation began to shift. Small changes at first, barely noticeable. The kind of variations that could be explained by imperfect memory, by stress, by confusion of a crisis. But the investigators noticed patterns. And as they dug deeper, the timeline didn't add up. Stephen said Jenny was here, but witnesses placed her there. He said they spoke at this time, but phone records showed something different. He said she left with these belongings, but those items were later found in his possession. And then technology entered the investigation. Cell phone pings, showing where Jenny's phone had been, where Stephen's phone had been, where they'd overlapped and where they hadn't. Surveillance footage, grainy but damning, showing vehicles at locations that contradicted Stephen's account. GPS data, the digital breadcrumbs that modern cars leave behind, tracking every journey. Financial records, purchases made, locations visited, times and dates that told their own story. Technology doesn't care how convincing you sound. It doesn't care about your credentials. It records the truth. And slowly, methodically, investigators began assembling that truth. Stephen spoke to investigators multiple times, long interviews, hours of conversation, and he was confident. This is important to understand. Stephen wasn't nervous. He wasn't invasive in the way guilty people often are. He was calm, articulate, cooperative, at least on the surface. He believed he could control the investigators the same way he controlled Jenny. He used language carefully, chose words precisely, presented himself as helpful, concerned, confused about what might have happened to Jenny. He minimized their relationship problem, just normal couple stuff, nothing serious. He rationalized anything that might seem suspicious, reasonable explanations for behavior that raised red flags. He redirected attention away from himself, suggested other possibilities, other suspects, other explanations. He used his professional background as a shield, reminded them he worked in domestic violence prevention, understood these situations, would never hurt someone he cared about, but confidence became a liability when facts intervene. Stephen was so certain he could talk his way through the investigation that he didn't realize how much evidence was accumulating, how many of his statements were being contradicted by digital records, how thoroughly his timeline was falling apart under scrutiny. Because investigators who specialize in these cases recognize the patterns. They know how sophisticated abusers operate. They understand that most dangerous perpetrators are often the ones who seem least capable of violence. And slowly, Stephen's narrative began to slip from his grasp. The confidence wavered. The explanations became more convoluted. The gaps in his story widened. When Jenny's remains were found, the investigation shifted from missing person to homicide. The reality could no longer be denied, could no longer be explained away, could no longer be blamed on misunderstanding or coincidence. Jenny was dead, and Stephen Zelich stood at the center of the case. The physical evidence told the story Stephen had tried to erase. Forensics could determine cause of death. They could establish timeline. They could connect remains to specific locations. And those locations connected to Stephen. His vehicle had been there. His phone had pinged nearby towers. Surveillance footage placed him in the area. Every piece of the puzzle fit together. Every attempt to scatter the evidence had ultimately created a trail investigators could follow. Digital forensics uncovered something else too. The images Stephen had used to control Jenny. The documentation of abuse. The evidence of sexual exploitation. These weren't just crimes against a person. They were crimes against someone who was no longer here to speak for herself. Someone whose voice had been silenced, first by coercion, finally by murder. And now the evidence would have to speak for her. In court, the mask finally cracked completely. The calm, professional demeanor. The articulate explanations, the confident presence, all of it fell away under the weight of evidence and testimony. Jurors heard about the manipulation, the isolation, the surveillance, the sexual exploitation, the threats, the images used as leverage. They heard from experts who explained coercive control, how it operates, how it escalates, how it can be invisible to outsiders while being devastating to victims. They heard about Jenny's life, who she'd been before Stephen, who she might have become if she survived. They saw the pattern, not a single act of violence, but a sustained campaign of control that lasted months or years, a deliberate, systematic destruction of another person's anatomy. And then they saw where the campaign led. To murder. To dismemberment. To disposal of human remains. To an attempt to erase Jenny from existence. The evidence was overwhelming. the prosecution laid out the timeline that Stephen couldn't effectively challenge. Digital records that couldn't be explained away. Physical evidence that connected him directly to the crime. And most damningly, Stephen had killed Jenny because she wanted to leave. Because he couldn't control her life anymore. So he controlled her death instead. Stephen Zelich was convicted. The jury deliberated, reviewed the evidence, discussed the testimony, and reached a unanimous conclusion. Guilty. The sentencing came next. Life in prison. No possibility of parole. A man who once claimed to protect victims, who built his career around preventing the very violence he committed, would never again have access to a vulnerable person. Would never again be in a position of trust. Would never again be able to hurt someone the way he hurt Jenny. Justice in this case meant isolation. The same isolation Stephen had imposed on Jenny, now imposed on him. Permanent separation from society, from the ability to manipulate, from the power he craved. For the rest of his natural life, Stephen Zelich would have nothing but time to think about what he'd done. Though whether someone like him is capable of genuine remorse, that's a question I can't answer. Jenny was more than evidence. She was more than images Stephen created. She was more than a case file or a headline or a statistic. She was a person with dreams that will never be realized, with potential that will never be fulfilled, with relationships that were cut short, with a future that was stolen from her. In the aftermath of cases like this, we often hear about the perpetrator, their background, their psychology, their crimes. But I want us to remember Jenny, to hold a space for who she was, to acknowledge that she deserved safety, deserved love, deserved life, free from fear. To recognize that she was a victim, but she was also a full human being with value that existed completely independent of what was done to her. Jenny's life mattered. Her story matters. And hopefully, in telling it, we can honor her memory and learn something that might protect someone else. This case forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth about abuse. It doesn't always leave bruises. It doesn't always look like the violence we've been taught to recognize. Sometimes it looks like concern, like care, like love even. Sometimes it operates through words instead of fists, through isolation instead of physical restraint, through psychological manipulation instead of visible wounds. Coercive control is insidious because it's invisible to outsiders. Friends and family don't see the surveillance, the constant monitoring, the erosion of anatomy. They see a couple. They might notice the victim seems quieter than before, less engaged, but they attribute it to stress or life circumstances. They don't see the cage being built. And because coercive control is invisible, it's incredibly difficult to escape. How do you ask for help when there's no emergency to point to? When you're not injured? When explaining what's happening requires describing 1,000 small moments that individually seem insignificant? Jenny tried to leave, and it cost her her life. That's the reality we need to face. The conversation we need to have as a society. Because until we recognize coercive control as violence, until we create legal frameworks that address psychological abuse, until we believe victims when they tell us they're being controlled even without visible evidence, more people will die. More Jennies will be silenced. And more Stevens will hide behind masks of respectability while committing atrocities behind closed doors. Stephen Zelich did not live in shadows. He didn't lurk in dark alleys or operate from the margins of society. He lived among us. He had a job, a reputation, credentials that opened doors. He was trusted by institutions, by vulnerable people, by communities. He was respected. He was believed. And that's why the story matters so much, because monsters don't always announce themselves. They don't always fit our preconceived notions of what danger looks like. Sometimes they wear the mask of help. Sometimes they speak the language of care. Sometimes they have resumes that suggest they're the last person who would ever hurt someone. But credentials don't prevent violence. Professional knowledge can be weaponized. And understanding abuse doesn't mean someone is incapable of committing it. Sometimes, as Steven Zelich proved, it just means they know exactly how to get away with it. You are not weak from being in this situation. You are not stupid for not seeing it earlier. You are not broken. You are surviving something that's designed to make you feel exactly those things. And you are not alone. To Jenny, wherever you are remembered. Your story is told. Your life is valuable, and you deserve so much better than what you received. I'm Maya Vale, and this has been Among Monsters, a podcast about the people who hide in plain sight and the lives they destroy. Until next time, pay attention to the masks people wear. But more importantly, pay attention to the people who might be trapped behind someone else's mask. Because sometimes, recognizing the danger isn't about spotting monsters. It's about noticing when someone's light is slowly being dimmed.